We're going to go back again to verse 13. What we need to hear from God is a word of comfort, encouragement, hope. We have enough words from others and from ourselves to discourage us. It's enough guilt laid out to saturate all of us with. That's not the thing. The thing we want to look at is the great grace of God, His power to care for us and keep us, and His grace and kindness in dealing with us. A very important thing to keep in mind is this. In the Old Testament, the Israelites were considered children of God, even if they misbehaved sometimes, maybe often. They might be penalized, judged, punished, but they were never thrown out of the family of Israel. They're still children of God. How much more in the New Testament, when we identify with Christ, are we made members of His family in spite of the fact that we don't always function properly? And there are all kinds of levels of misfunction or dysfunction. People get out of sorts. They get off base. They get out of the will of the Lord. And they do things and say things that are offensive. But still, they belong to God. Some things we do get us into difficulty. We have consequences following our actions. Some things we do hurt others. Some things others do hurt us. Some things we do may hurt the Lord. But generally speaking, we have to see all of that in the context of members of the family and not in terms of whether the Lord is going to stay with us or leave us. Tried to get that across to you. He doesn't run out the back door just because you have a little trouble inside. He's not like a little kid that leaves home every time he gets a little difficulty. More husbands or wives who leave because they get a little difficulty. Christ stays with us. The hope is still out there. The expectation is out there of what ultimately the Lord is going to do with us. Now we go through trouble, difficulty, sorrow, failure. But the expectancy is that when we come to the end of this life and all of its sorrows and misfortunes and misadventures, that we're going to be with Christ for eternity. This has been like the football game I so often talk about. You've been out there in the field. You've gotten battered and bruised. You make a few touchdowns, and you win a few games and lose a few games. You see, but then in the end, it's over, and whatever is. But we're still with Christ. Jesus Himself said, "No man shall pluck them out of my Father's hand." I've often had to say to you, just to be honest about it, that I cannot guarantee to you that no one would ever want to leave Christ, or that if they wanted to leave Christ and did, that they couldn't do that. Well, I can say this to you on the strength of the Word: as long as you want to stay with Christ, He'll stay with you. That I know, and guarantee that to you. So you may have difficulty in your life, but as long as you still want Christ in your life, He's there. I even have to accommodate the possibility that somebody in a fit of distress or temper might say, get out of my life or something. That he doesn't listen to that any more than the parent listens to it when the child says that. So I'm not talking about people who in a fit of disappointment or disillusionment or whatever might have some harsh words to say to Christ. I'm talking about the person who would make a final decision and say, "I do not want to be part of Christ's family yet." I don't even know if that's possible. I don't know of anyone that's ever done that. But I'm not an absolutist, and I have to say, maybe it's possible. But one thing is true, that as long as you want Christ in your life, it's obvious that He's there. You wouldn't want Him. See? So that's where your guarantee comes. I've often said the fact that you walk in this door here tonight, come to this meeting, shows that Christ is in you, or you wouldn't want to come. Now, in that context, I like how people just relax and not feel that the things we're saying are life and death guilt trips, to say, well, if you don't do this, you're in real trouble, or if you do this, or whatever. But just you relax and you say, let's look at our relationship to Christ and see what good things are there, and see what ways we can kind of help to shape things up. But I'm not speaking in the sense that if you don't do the things I say, you're in bad favor with God, see? Or you're out of favor with Him. See? All right, so I'm always glad to give the words of encouragement and comfort to you as members of the family of Christ. And this verse, the 13 in Romans 15, is one of these very comforting words. We started it last week, and we spoke of the God of hope. And I said to you then that the word hope really means expectation, the God of expectation or expectancy. And I said to you then that what we really have as an expectancy, as an expectation, is that whatever this life may be, it's coming to an end, and we have an eternity where things are straightened out. That's not just looking at pie in the sky by and by, but it's encouraging to know that you have another chance in life. Because most of us, somewhere down the line, foul things up. And we get ourselves hooked into things that we may be stuck with for the rest of our life. And it's comforting to know that that really isn't all that long. You know, that it isn't the final thing. No matter what this life has been for you or what it has produced for you, that phase of your existence will come to an end. Then when our spirits are released from this world to be with Christ for eternity, it's a different story. That's why I say you're on the football field. You may have lost a few games, and things may look a little bad for you, but ultimately the season will come to an end, and win, lose, or draw, you're still with Christ, and you have an eternity out there ahead of you where things will be all right. That's really a very important thing. You know, you can talk to a room full of people, and you can talk about all the virtues of making the right decisions and the right choices and marrying the right person and getting the right jobs and finding the Lord's guidance for your life and all that. It's all a lot of nice ivory-towered stuff. But most of the people in the room have already made these decisions. And they've already had their licks and their falls and their problems and so forth. And so you're not really comforting anybody much. If you get with a bunch of young people that have never gotten married yet, you can talk to them about choices in marriage and all that sort of thing, and the happy home and all those nice good things. But, you know, for the people that I minister to, for the most part, we've all done our thing, and we've all made our mistakes, and a lot of things we'd do over again if we could. You know what I mean? And so what I have to say is then we take the game that we're part of now. We don't walk off the field and trust the Lord to hang in there with us. And when the ball game is over, we've done our best. Given our circumstances, we've come to Christ. Sometimes people have come later in life, and their life is already set in a certain pattern. Nothing they can do to change it. Nothing. But they can be at peace with Christ in the midst of it, and they can have the perspective they need to handle it, cope with it. That's all I'm trying to help you do is cope with your life. And I hear people talking about victory this and victory that, you know, and deliverance and all that stuff, and it's nice. But I know from 150 years of experience that by and large, most of the people in the room are not going to get much of a change in their situation. But they can learn to cope with what they've got. Like this fellow said to me, you know, a few weeks ago, a fellow came, and he represents some group that are always victory-oriented, everything, deliverance and so forth. And so he said something to me about, don't you believe in positive recreation, something like that. He was thinking, you know, that we've all got to function victoriously. And I said, no, I said, I just think people have problems and they cope with them day by day and the Lord gets them through. That's all. And that's what it is. But it's the inner strength you have to cope with it. To hang in there day after day and to know that ultimately you do have an expectation. In a way, it's kind of like the person that's going through university. You struggle and sweat and strain and you get some good grades and some bad and whatever and you take your lumps. In the end, you know you're going to get through and you're going to get your diploma. Now, that's the way it is now. You're on this earth and you're struggling with your life. The day will come when you're through with this. And it isn't all that long. Most of us here have fewer years to live than we've already lived, you know, at best. And so what's the big deal? It's a preparation. Now, that's what expectation is, the God of hope, the God of expectation. not, as I said last week, not hope in the uncertain sense that we hope this will happen, but in the sense that out there ahead is the sunrise. You know, the night is about over. The sunrise is out there. And it won't be much longer that we're here on this earth. And then we have eternity, not just of drifting like a bunch of ghosts in the stratosphere, but a real life, a meaningful life, with these very difficult problems resolved. I mean, they're over, they're ended, and no more. But you see, you've done your stint here. Good, bad, or indifferent, you've done it. Some things you've done well, some things not well. But it's over. You know, that's it. Some lines that we wrote some time ago, pressing onward to the eternal portals, besieged mortals, struggling with life, reaching out for that to which their soul may cling, a moment of pleasure, a moment of pain, a moment of purpose, and then to wing, and all we ever were is in the hands of God. See, just think about that. You live today and you live tomorrow. You do well today, you do not well tomorrow, or you didn't do very well yesterday, you'll do better the day after. You know, you live. Good, bad, and indifferent. You feel good some days and you feel not good some days. You react well some days, you don't react well some days. But you live it out, you see that? Day after day, and Christ is in you. He understands the sandbox stuff. Keep that in mind. We're all a bunch of kiddies in a sandbox. And he presides over that cosmic sandbox as sort of the genial parent, you know, patiently accommodating the brats in the box. It's the grace of God to get you through. You think when you're young that you're just going to climb the ladder a rung at a time, you get smarter and smarter and wiser, and your life's going to get more and more organized, right? You think you get everything under control. You think you're going to learn how to live, and you're going to accumulate your money and so forth, and you're just going to be smarter and smarter all the time. But you see, part of the problem for us older folk is that we are very disappointed that we're not smarter.
Yeah, right.
And you go out and you buy something and from some huckster somewhere, and you kick yourself after. You think, what did I do that for? You see, well, you don't know what you did that for. And you lend somebody some money, as we should say. You lend a little money to somebody, and you think, now, what did I do that for? You know, and they don't pay you back or something. It's just all kinds of things that you think you're smart enough not to do, but you do them anyway. And you don't know why you do them. You can't for the life of you say why you did that. From impulse, like impulse buyers, you see. And, of course, stores are all set up. The merchandisers have set everything up for impulse buyers. The moment you walk in the front door, if it's a smart merchandiser, he's got that stuff out there that you're going to just pick up on the way through. Even old folks like us who are wise and smart still succumb sometimes to that sort of thing. So that's just a trivial way to look at it. But in the end, the problem that we have is that we think we should have been smarter. And if you can just relax a little bit and understand that you're never too old to be a fool, and you're never going to learn enough to know, to think that you're not ignorant. And you're never going to be controlled enough to know you'll never be a child, you see. The child comes out, even in the adults. Meanwhile, Christ has it all under control, the overall. He's the guardian, the parent. He functions, I suppose, a lot like a mother who has an awful lot of things to keep in hand in a day's time. She's got to keep everything in a way under general control, and that's quite a task. Some men don't understand that. To keep certain numbers of children together and under control, plus getting the work done and so forth. Most of these women do a pretty amazing job of just keeping the place from falling apart, and that's good if they can do that. So as I've often said, the husband comes home at night and he wants to know why everything isn't in order and why you haven't got the kids under control. And so he's going to set about to get everything straightened out. And all he does is louse it up, because the woman has learned over the years just how much she can do and what she can't do, how far to let the kids go and how far or when to stop. And, you know, there's some things you just have to let go. You just have to let the children scrap it out. You can't just be jumping on the kids every minute of the day to function well. Generally speaking, over the day's activities, you get to the end of the day and the place is still standing and the kids haven't killed each other. And you feel that that's pretty good, that you've won. If you come to the end of the day and everybody's still there. You have to understand that that's the way Christ functions. If we think he's going to come in there and straighten out every little wrinkle in our lives and make everybody who doesn't like us, and make everybody take back the mean things they said, and keep us from making foolish mistakes and so forth. If you think he's going to just preside over your life every minute and see that you run everything smoothly, you're mistaken. Now, he's going to help you if you ask for his help. You can say, Lord, give me wisdom about this or that. There are a lot of things we just do as human beings that the Lord watches, but he doesn't enter into it necessarily. Now, that's to keep you from feeling that if you're a Christian, everything in your life ought to be orderly. Because it just isn't going to be orderly. And if you think it's going to be, you're in for a shock. Because you're going to wind up in that box at the end of your life, and you're going to say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't get everything straightened out yet. Let me out. I speak kind of lightly of this thing of death because I don't really care one way or the other. And some people get a little offended, especially if they've confronted death recently. But I don't mean to be sacrilegious or callous about it. I just confronted it enough in my life that it doesn't bother me anymore. But it's something to really think about. And I've said it before. I've, over a period of 30 years, performed a great number of funerals. Great number. Just got through doing one last Saturday. And I don't think I've ever yet put anyone away that I felt had gotten all the loose ends tied together in their life. But you think that's your birthright, more or less, that if you start out at this end of life, by the time you get to this end, you ought to have everything all tied up in a neat package. And you may have more loose ends at the end of your life than you had at the beginning. So what does that say to you? That says relax and just take it a day at a time and don't be so anxious about it. It's not that crucial. That is in terms, let's say, of the Lord's evaluation of you. Now, we get in a syndrome from our early childhood, especially if we have parents that are rather perfectionist in their attitudes, that everything has got to be right. You know, everything's got to be squared away, and by the time you get to the end of the day, all the socks ought to be in the right drawer and everything else. I mean, that's symbolic, but, you know, they're always so over-anxious that the children perform well. And they dasn't bring home a report card with a C on it or something. Or they just want a pretty high degree of performance. So we're performance-oriented. To parents, any failure is a disaster. Now, the parents need to learn to relax a little bit about that. They get all excited about whether they made the right decision or not in the raising of their children. I get that all the time. You know, they look back over their raising the children and they're distressed over whether they did the right job or not. And the point is this, probably most techniques for raising children are only moderately successful anyway. In a school situation, I happen to have been connected pretty tightly with it, and even currently some. But parents get all in a dither over how their children are being handled by someone else. The point is that none of the techniques are all that great for disciplining children. You think, oh, if only I'd handle it differently, you know, if only I'd use this method or that method. And what's the method to use? There isn't any method to use. And you just do the best you can with what you've got. And it's all relative. And no matter the best that you do, some of them are going to go astray and some of them aren't. And you can use all the finest techniques of handling children. Methods of discipline are all relative. You do, you know, you just get a certain amount of order out of it. But to feel that the way you handle your child now is going to be crucial to whether they survive or not is a moot point, you see. So all of that goes down the line of saying that we get anxious about whether we've done everything just right or not. And I want to say to you that Christ is not like that as a parent, looking over our shoulder to be sure that every move we've made today has been correct. You get into things you shouldn't get into, probably. You make decisions you shouldn't make. But he's not there to keep a scorecard. Now, there are a lot of religious groups that believe that he does. A lot of religious groups, they want every minute of your day in the center of God's will. Now, that's enough to drive anybody crazy. If you think that the Lord is looking over your shoulder, and if you make one false move, you've got a little lash coming to you. You get a check mark against you. You can make a lot of bad moves, and still the Lord's your faithful parent and guide and guardian and so forth. Now, we shouldn't make bad moves. I'm not taking lightly decision-making. I think we may pay some pretty heavy bills for careless moves. You get yourself under a contract, for example, that the Lord himself can't really get you out of. You know, people go in, they sign up for music lessons plus an instrument. And it's so easy that they're going to provide the instrument for you, and your lessons are only going to cost you $2 or $3 a piece. Then you wind up with a $3,000 or $4,000 contract, and you got to pay for that contract. Now that's a foolish move. I've talked to some people who've had those problems, and the kid runs out of interest in the machine and in the instrument, and then they're stuck with the contract. You can't say, "Well, I'll give him lessons until he gets tired of it, and I'll stop." You don't stop those kind of lessons. I mean, pay your contract out. Now, the reason I said that is we make moves like that. We don't ask the Lord and say, "Lord, do you think this is a wise contract to enter into?" We just think Junior ought to play the pipes, and so we sign up. All right, then we're stuck with this. Are we going to have a food freezer or something like that? We don't pray and ask the Lord to guide us, and we get stuck with those things. They're bad moves. But the Lord is not going to say, you should have prayed about it. You made a bad move, and you'll pay the bill. And that's true with a lot of decisions you make. You take a job that may not be the best job, or you do things and say things that are not the best. If you would ask the Lord for guidance for these things, he'd probably give it to you. I think you could ask him for guidance. Before you sign on the dotted line, pray about it. Say, "Lord, what do you think?" He may give you enough sense. In fact, what I've often prayed, and I think it's a very good prayer, "Lord, help me to know the things I ought to know to make the decisions I have to make." If you've got an important decision, ask him to bring things out. Maybe a slip of the salesman's lip may save you from sinking your ship. You see. And you'll find, something will come out and you'll say, "Hey, wait a minute, that's not a good deal." The Lord will give you a little insight if you pray about it. But if you don't pray about it, all you got to do is pay the bill. But you don't need to think that was a spiritual problem, you see, to say, "Well, I wasn't very spiritual because I didn't pray about it." I'm really only trying to say to you that you just be at ease, live out your life, know you're going to make foolish mistakes, know that everything isn't going to work out well, know that all the loose ends are not going to be tied together, and therefore, don't be disappointed in yourself, you see. Don't be on a guilt trip. That adds insult to injury. Just say, "Well, I'm a human being doing the best I can, and I do this and that, and the Lord's with me." And there's no way to explain a lot of things that take place in your life. You don't know why they happened, why you got into this or out of that. But you put your life in the Lord's hands, and his grace functions in you day after day. He is steady. We aren't steady. It isn't how you feel about your faith. It is the energy within you of God that sustains you anyway. It isn't whether you do everything well or not. It is that you care about Christ and that your heart is open to him. Your heart is right. The actions may not always be right, but your heart is right. That's what the Lord's looking at. And he oversees this cosmic sandbox, the best way I can describe it. Knows the kids are kicking sand around. Knows there are going to be disappointments and the sandcastles are going to crumble. He knows all of that. You're not shocking the Lord by your actions. He knows all of that. And he's with you in it. These are things that are important. As I've worked with young people a lot, where you warn them about something, you try to steer them clear, and they don't take it, and they get in trouble. I always had this policy with my young people. When they got into trouble, now it is not the time for recriminations. Now it's the time to get in and help get out of trouble. See? You don't stand around and tell them, "I told you so," or anything else. Now you got, as a parent, you help them all you can to get out of trouble. Now, I understand that there's some things you can't cover for them. You shouldn't. I'm not talking about covering for the young people. I'm talking about being a good parent to do what we want the Lord to do for us. Isn't that right? We make our mistakes, and we don't want the Lord to just stand around pointing a finger at us. We want Him to help us get out of it if we can. And He stays with us in it, and He gives us the comfort we need. It's the high evaluation we have of ourselves that causes the trouble. We think we're just too smart to do those things, and we aren't. Be at peace with yourselves. The Lord brought you or allowed you to come into the world. He made the place. You didn't ask for it to be made. You didn't ask to come here. But you're here. So you do the best you can with it. And I'm not sure the Lord can expect any more than that. So I just want you to be comforted and encouraged. Your problem now is not tying up all the loose ends in your life. Your problem is coping with life every day. Where you can work things out, fine. Where you can help your young people work them out, that's fine. Where you can reverse decisions, that's fine. But just be at peace, relax. Now when he says the God of hope, the God of expectation, fill you with joy and peace, I'm saying to you that we can't expect a whole lot out of this life. Our expectation is that when this treadmill is over, we do have an eternal life that is going to be free of all of these difficult things that we have to cope with today. So you can look forward to that. I remember working with a fellow that had been in an accident, and he was left like a vegetable, state of coma. His poor wife there trying to cope with the thing. But, you know, the encouraging thing about it was only this, that whereas she might face a life, the rest of her married life, with a man who was in a coma, which is a pretty severe thing, yet even then, it wouldn't be many years before that was over. See, it was a hard thing, but it was not a permanent thing in terms of eternity. Whatever handicaps people may have, they seem permanent as far as this world is concerned, but they're not really permanent. You're in a bad situation. It may seem permanent, but it's not really permanent. It's only for the rest of the game, you see, the rest of the time on the earth. And if you can get through that and you can cope with it, fine. Don't try to become great spiritual persons. Just cope with what you've got. Therefore, don't judge yourselves as whether you're spiritual or not. If I'd only been more spiritual, I wouldn't be in this situation, you see. Don't judge yourselves that way. Just take it a day at a time and trust Christ and be at peace. That's what the God of expectation is all about. Not necessarily here. So don't feel guilty if your life on the earth isn't all tied together. But in a lot of religious groups, it would seem that that's what they're after, that if you once come to Christ, He'll straighten everything out for you. Your life will be glorious. Just isn't always that glorious. All right, then he says, the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing. Now, how can you have joy and peace? Especially, and maybe just tonight, how can you have joy? We've got to look at that, because the Bible is full of expressions that have to do with joy and rejoice and so forth. Now, look, it's inappropriate for us to sit here and just say, oh, how lovely life is, praise Jesus, you see. And here are these souls over there in Poland just, you know, in deep distress. We might at least have a sense of camaraderie to say, Lord, you know, I have to be concerned about that. It isn't a grand, victorious world. Now, there are a lot of people in Poland that are Christian people. A lot of them. It doesn't matter so much what the religious connection per se is. It's a country that, in essence, has a great tie to Christ. Yes, it may be under religious organization, and people sometimes are a little worried about the organization, but, I mean, those people, you leave that to the leaders. The people, the grassroots Pole, is a person of faith. And they are our brothers and sisters. The communist thing is a facade. That they don't even believe that. Very few communists in Poland. Was run by the Communist Party, now by a military junta, whatever Soviet Union may have to do with it, I don't know, but I mean, it's hard to tell. But basically, you're talking about a nation of people who honor Christ. Now, I have to feel concerned about that. I don't come here to unite rejoicing and jumping up and down for joy. The world is a concern to me. But what kind of joy do we have or can we have? That's the question. And I want to straighten that out for you. Because our English words are so impoverished, just like the word love that I talked to you about at length, the word joy has also a lot of problems. We sing about, especially at this time of the year, joy to the world, and we jump for joy and all this sort of thing. The word joy is just a word that doesn't mean anything. It means too many things. You have the joy boys and the joy bells and the all the things that... the word doesn't mean anything. So we go back to the Greek word, which in English letters would be C-H-A-R-A, chara. The root of that word is the same root for gift, grace, thankfulness, forgiveness. The word Eucharist, the communion, is from the same word. So you have a concept in Greek out of which many different words are formed. But the basic idea here is a free-flowing benevolence from God, or a free-flowing energy, if you will, from God. It is God flowing out to the world and to us in goodwill. In other words, the Greek word here conveys the idea that deep within you there is a river of divine goodwill, of God's goodwill. That has nothing to do with a lot of frivolity or jollity or whatever. It hasn't to do with jumping up and down like a jumping bean. It has to do with a deep flow of divine grace and help inside of us. It's the energy of God flowing in our hearts. Now, in a way, it's like the word faith. I can get pretty philosophical about this, but let me just give you the bottom line on it. That faith basically involves, in the Greek word, commitments. What we mean by that is that faith is that which the mind is committed to. And that means something that is just there, that is not changeable. For example, for us in the room, I would say probably all of us, our mind is so committed to the idea of God that it's just a natural part of our lives. Like other things in nature that we absolutely are certain of. Law of gravity, for example. None of us here will walk out that front door tonight with the thought that possibly when we step over the threshold, the law of gravity be reversed and we'll be shot up to the moon. We don't think that. And we think that the laws of motion are pretty stable, that when we get in our automobile and start the engine up, it's not going to jump straight up in the air. It's going to roll down the highway. Those are things our brain is committed to such a degree that we just live with it. Or we think when we sit down on a chair, it'll hold us. Or we get on an airplane and we assume it's going to fly. These are assumptions we make about life that we live with. We have an assumption within us, a deep assumption that things are pretty much as they seem and are going to go on and on and on. All right, now that's what we mean by faith in terms of commitment, that our mind is so committed to the idea of God that that's just part of our life. We don't have to prove it or disprove it. It's just there. Now, in order for that to be there, for the mind to be committed to God, who is way beyond us, there has had to be a flow of energy from God through our brain that represents this commitment. Just like an energy flow, like turning on the switch and the light goes on, you see. In a way, God turns on a switch and the light goes on in our mind that says God. God is there. He does that for us. So we We come here week after week after week expecting something. In our mind, there is a sense of God that makes it very natural for us to walk out the door of our home and come over here and sit down and listen to this fellow. You know. And it isn't at all absurd to us to do that. It isn't at all a problem to do it. We do it gladly. But if I came here every week and talked to you about Alice in Wonderland, you probably wouldn't stay around very long. I could become the great spokesman for the Walt Disney characters or something, and you wouldn't even sit still for it because it's not of substance. No matter how eloquently I might argue the point, you're not interested. Now, when we come and talk about God, there's a drawing there. You're interested. You come. It makes sense to you. It touches the strings there, and it is real. That is not because of the great persuasive eloquence of the speaker at all. If I thought so, I'd be crazy. It's because the word is given and the Spirit of God makes that word real to your hearts. You could find a lot better logical presentation of things than I would give you. But it isn't the logic. It's the fact that the Spirit of Christ has a word for you. And you, it comes and it touches your hearts. Now that's the flow of faith, the energy of faith. Now, by the same token, there is a flow within you of divine benevolence, of goodness, God's goodwill. And it's there. And it causes you to be at peace about things, ultimately. And it's that undercurrent of good feeling, or of, not that isn't of harmony, perhaps. That you can face life because you have that deep inner sense that God is there and that He wishes and wills good for you rather than evil. He wants good in your life. That doesn't mean goodies. You know, the sense of things that God is there and He cares. That's what we really mean by this river of joy, or by this chara. It's the same word as the word for grace. And that's what it's all about. God is with you tonight in the midst of the problems, the foibles and follies of humankind. He's there, and deeply within us we have a sense of peace. But the Lord is, after all, out there looking after us. Well, let's pray. Thank you, Father, for these words tonight. Pray the Spirit of Christ may be there to make real to the heart the things that have been said. In Christ's name, amen.